Good morning and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians. All while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you the opportunity to participate in the show. Now, here are your hosts for Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat, along with their co-host, Lynette Morgan.
Oh, good morning to you.
And good morning to you.
Oh.
And I don't know where Samira's at this morning.
That's right. You didn't send her far, far away to a conference?
No, I didn't send her far, far away. And okay. She didn't mention anything to me yesterday about not being here. So
and the Huskies aren't playing.
And the Huskies aren't playing. So I hope she hasn't had an accident or something.
Yes.
Hoping. Anyway, if there is a question for Samira, I'll just go to falsetto and ask her.
there you go. Yeah. You better answer it. I'm just the phone answerer. Oh, good morning. Good morning. We are live in the studio. Dr. Jerry Mixon here. I'm Lynette, and we're going to take your calls. And, of course, we always urge you to call at the beginning of our show with your questions about your health, about aging, about what's that new symptom or that new diagnosis you didn't really get to discuss with your doctor. We're here, and we want to help you through that so you can understand. And we learn so much. On this show. That's the thing I used to tell my mom. I would just talk to her all the way home and was like, whoa, mom, did you know this and this and this? You just learn so much.
Yeah, well, I've been learning so much in the last month.
I bet.
I have kind of fallen into a couple of research areas that are showing incredible promise in extending the health span. And perhaps the lifespan, secondarily, because if people are healthy, they're less likely to die, unless they do stupid things like use drugs or step in front of buses.
Oh, boy.
But, healthy people seem to live longer than sick people. It's just the way it works. And there are some fascinating things going on. You know, one of the things I've been frustrated for years now is a way to determine who needs to have their senescent cell load diminished.
Okay.
How far do we need to diminish it? How often do we need to retreat them? Should we be retreating them? And there are some people at Rutgers University that I am trying very hard to get into, to talk to, that I think may have an answer for us.
Wow.
Yeah. Some tests that they describe as simple, elegant, and reproducible. Well, it may be simple to them, but I went through their experimental protocol, the procedures.
Yes.
And my eyes glazed over about halfway through them. So it might be simple for them, but for a simple country doc like me, not all that simple. No. But, but I would love to have a long conversation with them, because if that system they've come up with for actually measuring the amount of senescent cell load in our bodies at any given time, done with a simple blood test.
Wow.
Okay.
Okay.
A simple blood, simple on in drawing the blood and sending it to their lab.
That's the easy part, yes.
Doing the test is the tough part. But if I can actually start measuring that with a blood test, then I can know, A, at what point should we be treating people?
Mm-hmm.
When do we need to retreat them? You know, how often, with how much? It gives us a good idea of the things we're doing that are supposed to be slowing senescent cell load, such as high-dose resveratrol and quercetin and rapamycin and so on. How effective are they being in any given individual instead of just a population? You know, statistics we gather apply to the population as a whole, not to any given individual. Some people are going to be high, some low.
Mm-hmm.
That is going to, if it pans out, be revolutionary for those of us that are treating people's senescent cell loads. And the other one is on thymus regeneration. I had a call a month or two ago about thymus regeneration. And I had to tell the guy I didn't know a whole lot about it because...
I remember that.
Yeah, because thymus regeneration requires growth hormone. And in Washington State, we can't use growth hormone, so I've never spent much time looking at it. But the thymus is a large gland when we're babies. It's right under our sternum and our chest, up in front of the heart. And it is the gland that makes our T cells, our memory cells that help us to maintain protection against diseases. You get infected, you make these memory T cells, they sit there, and next time that bug comes along, you're able to kill any infected cells and recover in a hurry. And that gland starts to shrink in adolescence about the time of puberty.
Oh, wow.
And by the time we're adults, you can't even find it.
Oh, boy.
It's so tiny. Now, it's still there. It still has some thymus cells, but they're very inactive. And this is a big part of, as those thymus cells that we produced in our youth and have been sitting there for, in my case, 76 years, as they're wearing out and we're getting fewer and fewer of them and they're getting used up and they become senescent themselves, old folks become more and more susceptible to cancer and infections, and our immune system is just generally declining all across the board. And so the caller called in and said, you know, what about thymus regeneration? Because they do regenerate thymus in people, for instance, that have had total body radiation for a bone marrow cancer.
Okay.
And we have to wipe out their entire immune system and all their bone marrow. And then we take some bone marrow from someone else and we put it back in. And then but it's been sterilized. And now we have to get the thymus gland back into some activity to help regenerate their immune system. So, you know, thymus regeneration is being done in oncology. It's being done in people with HIV.
Okay.
Because HIV destroys your immune system, and so you want to build up your immune system again. But for the rest of us that are just old, we can't use growth hormone for that purpose in Washington State.
Okay.
So,
right.
And besides, how do you measure thymus activity? You can do MRIs to measure thymus size, and there are studies showing that if you give people, you know, DHEA, zinc, and growth hormone, you can make their thymus get 4, 5, 6 times bigger than it was. But how active is it? That's the real thing.
Could be bigger, but just not as active.
Yeah. So thymus activity. Mm. And I came across a paper very recently about some guys doing research in actually a blood test that lets us to measure thymic activity by measuring the number of TRECs in their T cells.
Wow.
So anyway.
Okay. So there are things out there and you're starting to discover some of those.
Well, yeah.
Reading that.
Finding the papers was the easy part. The hard part is getting to talk to the people.
Okay.
I keep sending them emails and so on, and I'm not getting much of a response. So.
Okay. All right. Well, that's exciting.
Yep.
You know, I had never even heard of senescent cells until I started on the show with you almost 3 years ago. And it was like, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So much information and so much we don't know and things we can do.
I'm hoping 2024 is the year that I can track these guys down, you know, and perhaps even get a lab put together that can measure these things for us. You know, it's I'd even kick in a fair bit of money to try to get such a lab up and running because it would be very useful for those of us on the cutting edge of aging, longevity, medicine.
You mean the leading edge?
Yes.
The leading edge of medicine. There we go. All right. Well, thank you for that, Dr. Mixon. You ready for a phone call to jump right into? Here is the number to get through today, and we want you to call early so that you don't miss out and you call in and we can't get to you. 1-800-465-8770 is that number. 800-465-8770. We are headed to Buckley, and Lynn is on the line. Good morning, Lynn.
Hello, Buckley.
You're our first caller.
How are you today, sir? Oh, her. Adam.
And I'm fine. I have a couple of questions for you.
Okay.
I know that you use HRT, hormone replacement therapy creams, but I'm wondering what you think of sublingual ones.
Too short acting, primarily. The metabolic half-life of these hormones is relatively short. Estrogen's 3 to 4 hours, progesterone about 6 hours, testosterone 75 minutes. So if you get a quick dose under the tongue, your levels can go up quickly, although it's kind of hard to tell you how long they're going to stay at that level. So we have to be able to measure your peak value, which would be, what, maybe a matter of 2 or 3 minutes after you take the drug. And then we want to say, okay, and how long do your levels stay up? How high are they at any point during the day? And then what is the physiologic effect of a short burst of a particular hormone as opposed to having that hormone in your system throughout the day?
Okay, so it's more of a slow and steady delivery when you use a cream on thin skin?
Yes, absolutely. We're trying to recreate what your own body used to do. You know, when you were young with very active ovaries and adrenal glands, they would be producing the hormone 24 hours a day. Now, there were diurnal cycles during the day. Some points of the day would be higher than others. But your ovaries were kind of secreting estrogens and testosterone into your bloodstream on a continuous basis every hour of every day. And so your brain, your bones, your heart, your lungs, your skin all got the benefit of that 24/7. Why would you want to have the benefit for 20 minutes instead of 24 hours?
Difference.
Well, I'm not a proponent. It seems like it's something that's new to me, and I didn't know what you thought of it. A lot of thought in what you think.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of ways to administer hormones. You can do it with shots, and most of the shots use an ethanate or an oil of some sort so that you absorb it more slowly, and that will be, you know, a shot every week or two. Or you can do pellets, and you stick a pellet under your skin, and it dissolves over 3 to 4 months. You can take pills, although that whacks your liver pretty hard. I don't like that because it interferes with your clotting cascade. You can use sublinguals, or you can use creams. That seems to be our choices. And our clinic has opted the vast majority of the time for the creams. We do have a few people requesting pellets or shots, but they're a tiny, tiny minority.
Yeah. It seems like the biggest advantage is in the creams, but I hadn't heard what you thought about the sublingual, so I was wondering about that.
Yep. Yeah. Just duration of action is my only objection.
Okay. I understand. My other question is RSV vaccines for adults that are 65 or older, because if you listen in any kind of media, they'll scare the pants off of you thinking we're all going to end up with RSV if we're old. And I want to know, it's something brand new. I mean, well, I've been here a long time. I have never even...
Well, the media's emphasis on it is new.
Yeah.
The virus has been around for millennia. And most of us had RSV when we were babies. We were little kids. Respiratory syncytial virus is a very common virus. Almost every human being, at least in the Western world, I haven't seen statistics in Asia, but almost every human being I've ever heard of has been infected in childhood. The question is, as we old folks, you know, we're living longer, our immune systems are declining, our ability to fight infections. In fact, that was what I was just talking about with the T-cell problem. Our thymus produced T-cells that we made in childhood, mine have been around for 70-some years. You know, I'm 76 years old. My thymus started shrinking when I was around 10 or 11. And so I've been using the same old naive thymus cells for many, many years. Those that got exposed to respiratory syncytial virus when I was probably two or three and probably caught my first case, are probably getting kind of old and frail, and many of them are senescent, and, you know, they're kind of pooping out. And so the question is, at what point do we old folks need to get a boost, you know, get another immune boost to try to raise our level of immunity to this very common and ubiquitous virus? The problem is complicated, of course, by the fact that as we get older, we respond to vaccines less and less well because we don't make as good an immune response. You know, a person in their 60s and 70s will make about one-fifth the immune response of a person of 18 or 20. And so...
Big difference.
Yeah. And so, you know, which old folks need it and which folks don't. I don't know. I haven't gone out and got an RSV injection as yet myself. I've wondered about it from time to time, but I guess generally I do everything I can to keep my immune response boosted to the highest level I can at my age. If I were a cancer survivor, if I had immunodeficiency for being obese or for being diabetic or something, I'd probably go get the shot. But I'm lean, I'm strong, I'm fast. I'm going to put it off for a while yet.
All right.
Hold on a minute. Hold on, ma'am.
Yeah, Lynn.
That music says we got to go to a break.
Mm-hmm.
When we come back, okay, I'll talk to you some more, okay?
Yes. Stay right there on the line, Lynn. And here is our number to call with your questions as well for Leading Edge Medicine and Dr. Mixon. It's 1-800-465-8770. That's 1-800-465-8770. We'll be right back. I had a little snow at my house.
Yes.
We're talking snow.
Reminiscing, getting to work through the snow.
Yes, yes. A little crazy. And no snow here.
No snow here, though.
Oh, no snow
here. We didn't
do
that today.
No, and we're getting rain, so it'll probably be gone, most of it, wherever you are listening. If you're in the North End, you probably had some snow, too. But, like, way North End, where I am.
Bellingham.
Yes, yes, and beyond. Hey, 1-800-465-8770 is the number to call with your questions. Right now, talking with Lynn, talking about hormones and vaccines. And Lynn, you had one more question for the doctor?
Go ahead, Lynn.
I did. I was just wondering if there's a particular amount of risk with side effects with the RSV vaccine.
Yeah. Everything follows Dr. Mixon's first rule of medicine. Anything strong enough to help is strong enough to hurt. There's always a downside. You know, the most danger is quite simply allergic reactions, anaphylactic reactions. There are people who turn out to be seriously allergic to the components of the vaccine's manufacture. And that's true of every vaccine. And so, you know, those people have to be very, very, very cautious. Most people, the biggest problem is sore arm, maybe some swelling, some irritation. But the vast majority of people don't have much in the way of discernible side effects that last more than a couple of days.
So it's not something like COVID vaccine.
No. We are not seeing, you know, lots and lots of people dropping dead of cardiac arrest or stroking or having kidney damage and so on.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time and your answers. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call, Lynn. And you can call and get through just like Lynn at 1-800-465-8770 for Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Mixon. Headed to Seattle now, we have Rick on the line. Good morning, Rick.
Hello, Rick.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
We hear you're just fine, and I love that
deep
bass voice of
yours. I do, too. Wow.
I envy you. I'm sitting here with voice envy. You know that. But go ahead.
Feel free to share your story. Yeah.
Okay. Well, here's the thing. I've listened to Dr. Mixon and have called in a few times, and he talked about tadalafil, and I was interested in it, but not specifically for the usual reasons, but because of things like blood pressure help and diabetes possibilities. I don't have diabetes, but...
Lower risk of prostate cancer? Yeah.
Yeah, those kinds of things.
Sure, so, that's why I take it.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. If you're taking it for those purposes, as opposed to pre-intercourse kind of a thing, what is the regime for taking it? How often should you take it?
Most guys start at 5 milligrams a day, each day.
Okay, so you take it once a day, say in the morning.
Yep.
I do have some 5 milligram tablets. I wasn't sure if I should break them in half and take 2.5 instead of 5, but...
No, that's pretty piddly. Yeah,
okay.
the standard dose, and you know the justification that is often used to keep the insurance companies happy is you've got an older man with an enlarging prostate, and one of the things that tadalafil does for older men is to help him pee better. Okay, it's a muscle relaxer. It relaxes the muscles are in that urethra, expands it, and lets men urinate more efficiently. And, you know, if you tell the insurance company you need it for erectile function, they'll authorize 5 a month. For some reason, they've decided you don't need sex more than 5 times a month.
Wow.
You know, once a week, and then you get lucky. But if you're having trouble urinating, they know you have to do that every day, several times a day. So they'll give it to you 3 months at a time, 90 pills at a time, every 3 months, you can fill your prescription if you need it for urination. So that's what we tell folks. But the reality is, and while it does help us pee better, and that's good if you're a man, but isn't it nice that it cuts your risk of prostate cancer in half? Isn't it nice that it improves the blood flow to your brain so you think better? Isn't it nice that the blood flow to your muscles is improved so you get better exercise tolerance? Oh, and
how
about the fact...
Those are all the reasons that I wanted to take it.
Yes. By the way, if you had a solid tumor cancer, it slows the growth of the cancer. Okay, I like that one too.
All good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a question of... Because... I asked the pharmacist when I should take it. He said, before you have sex. And I tried to explain to him the reasons that I'm taking it. And he didn't have any answer. He said, well, I don't know. You know, just before you have sex was the only thing he could think of, you know.
Well, and that was the answer back in 1980-something.
Yeah. Yeah, but that isn't why I'm taking it. And so I thought, well, if I take it before I have sex, well, I'm not going to be doing that every day at my age, you know. So, if I should take it every day, then once a day, that's what I needed to know.
Yes. Yeah, I've got, I have 2 pill trays at my house. I have a white one for the morning and a blue one for night. And each week I load up my week's pills, usually on a Sunday. And every morning I take, you know, a handful of pills out of the white tray, and every night I take about half that many out of the blue tray, and, you know, so just take your pills. And it's just in my pills that I load each week every morning. So I'd suggest you do the same thing.
Terrific. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, sir. Take care.
Bye.
Very good. Thank you for the call, Rick. Here is that number to get through. Phone lines are wide open for you at Leading Edge Medicine. 1-800-465-8770 is the number. That's 1-800-465-8770. Okay, while we're waiting for that next call, Dr. Mixon, you talked about all the wonderful things about taking Tadalafil. You know, anything strong enough to help could,
strong
you know,
enough to hurt?
Yeah, what are some side effects potentially?
Well, the downside of Tadalafil is that it drops blood pressure a bit.
Okay.
So if you tend to get postural hypotension, which I do sometimes, if I've been sitting a long time and stand up, I sometimes have to bend over for a few seconds to get the blood back in my head because blood pressure gets a little too low, and you know it all wants to run to my feet when I first stand up. So you know, and that would go away if I stopped taking the Tadalafil. On the other hand, you know, I like all the other benefits. So
yes,
there's a trade-off.
You know? So you bend over and give your head
just
a
put
second
my head down
get up.
Out towards my about where my belly button used to be, and for 3 or 4 seconds the blood rushes back to my head, and I say, okay, I feel smart again. I stand up and move on.
Yeah. And that's postural hypertension.
Hypotension.
Okay. It
means low blood pressure. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's just because those expanded, dilated blood vessels don't constrict fast enough when you first stand up to push the blood back up to your head.
Okay.
So it runs down to your feet, you know. The other downside of it is since it is often, in fact, traditionally had been used as an erectile disorder drug, is it does give men better erections, but it also slows down climax in most men.
Oh, okay.
And in young men, that's a virtue because young men, shall we move into human sexuality here for a minute? I don't know how we avoid it with this particular topic.
That's right.
Young men have about 6 minutes from initial arousal to climax.
Okay.
Young women are about 27 minutes. And that's why young men and young women have a real mismatch. Okay. Because he's finished about the time she's getting interested.
Okay.
The good news for the young man is that's okay. Give him 3 minutes. He'll turn around and do it again.
There you go.
And last longer the second time. As we age, our erectile to climax plateau gets longer and longer and longer. Somewhere in their mid to late 40s, most men are a good match for most young women in their 20s.
Mm.
And this is one reason why many young women prefer a 15, 10 to 20 year old older man as a lover, because they have a matched climactic plane. They're finishing about the same time. No one of them isn't always end up unsatisfied.
Okay.
Right. But as men age, that climactic plane gets longer and longer and longer and longer. And some guys, by the time they're in their 60s and 70s, are still capable of having sex. They're in that minority that don't need an ED drug, but they have difficulty finishing. The happy ending is harder to achieve. And when they use an ED drug, it gets even harder because the erectile disorder drugs stretch out that plane even longer. So in your 30s, 40s, 50s, that's not a problem. But for some men in their 60s and 70s that already have, you know, a 30, 40 minute from arousal to finish, and you make it any longer with that drug, well, now you got a problem.
Okay.
Okay. So that's a downside. You know, you take it for sex, but it makes getting satisfied with sex more difficult.
As you age and as the longer you take it.
So you're able to have sex better.
Okay.
But that doesn't necessarily translate into better sex.
Hmm. Something to think about.
Yes.
All right. You're listening to Leading Edge Medicine. Dr. Jerry Mixon in the studio. We are live and we're taking your calls. We'd love to have you call right now with any of your questions regarding whatever we've talked about this morning, or maybe you've heard another show and you had a question. We invite you to call right now at 1-800-465-8770. That's 1-800-465-8770. We'll take a break, then we'll return. Stay right there.
Working 9 to 5.
working 9 to 5. That means we have another 27 minutes before we even start. Is that right?
That's what it would be. Yep.
We're
yep.
early birds. We're up. That's
That was a good movie, though. I really enjoyed
yes.
that movie.
Yeah.
A little anti-male, anti-boss, but, what the hell.
Oh, there you go. Oh, this is Leading Edge Medicine. We want your phone calls today. What are you thinking about?
Yes.
What is
going
on?
Everybody
with your
this
health?
Morning, they're all sleeping in. Oh, I'm too weak and tired. Come on, sober up. Give us a call. It was Friday night. I know you're all out dancing and carousing late into the night, but you got to give us a call and let us know what you want to talk about.
That's right. What are you,
otherwise,
what's going on?
You'll get
top
stuck,
of mind.
Yeah, you'll get stuck with what I want to talk about. And
that's right.
I'm not sure we really want to go there anyway.
Lately, it's been a lot of talk about hormones and, like you said, senescent cells. Rapamycin, something we didn't talk about up until, really started talking about a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
Really? Yeah, that's, been a big, big word. Now a lot of folks are really interested in wanting to know about that.
Yeah, well, rapamycin is I think is going to be a very useful drug.
Mm-hmm.
Once more, though, we don't really have great ways to measure its long-term effectiveness in human beings. We know that it extends the lifespan and the health span in essentially every animal we've ever tested it in, but we don't know about humans.
Okay.
And the problem with human testing is, of course, we live a long time. And so if you want to really see if it extends human lifespan, well, you got a 20 or 30-year test to do. And if you really want to know, should we start it when people are 20? Should we start it at 30, 40, 50, 60, 70? At what point do we start getting less and less effective? Most people currently are not starting it until they're in their late 60s or 70s, because that's when people suddenly realize, oh my God, I'm getting old.
Yes. I need to do something.
What can I do? Okay, I want to do something now. I want to do it right
now. Fix all the things right now.
Yeah, well, if you really wanted to do your best job of not getting decrepit, you needed to start when you were 35 or 40, most likely. But in the animal studies, rapamycin is a drug we can give to old animals.
Ah.
And they still live longer. And giving it to them younger doesn't seem to have any or much better effect, modestly better effect, but not much better. So giving it to middle-aged animals as opposed to old animals still extends their lifespan a little bit better.
Okay.
But you're taking the drug a lot longer. And very few 35-year-olds are willing to start spending the money to take a drug every week for the next 50 years. So, mostly it's people in their 60s and 70s where a lot of the damage has already been done.
Ah.
And you get a better effect if you prevent the damage than if you try to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've got plaque in your arteries, once you've got brain cells that are starting to die, once your bones are thinning out, once you've already got a high risk of cancer, anything we do for you at that point is going to be less effective than had we intervened before that happens. But how do you convince people when they feel great?
Yeah, that you need to do something.
That you
now.
Need to start treating yourself now for what's going to happen 20 years from now.
Yes.
And it's just doesn't fit the way humans are made very well. But reality is, if we really wanted to get our best results, I need people in our clinic when they're 30, not when they're 70. I can help them when they're 70,
mm-hmm.
but not as much as I could if they were to start 20 or 30 years earlier.
Okay. Well, you want to talk to talk about a 30-year-old right now? We have an off-air question.
Oh.
Yes, we do. Didn't want to stay on the show or didn't want to talk on the radio. That's okay. Alex from Seattle says she is in her 30s and her periods are more painful now than ever before. Curious what she can do to help alleviate the pain and the side effects. And why would it be worse in her 30s than it would be when she was much younger?
I can give her some educated guesses.
Mm-hmm.
But I can right offhand think of at least three different reasons, and they require different interventions.
Okay. and answers from Alex. So, Alex, if you're listening, give us a call.
For instance,
okay,
she may be developing endometriosis.
Okay.
In which the endometrium, how to explain this? The endometrium is the lining on the inside of the uterus.
Okay.
During the month, her estrogens and her progesterone rise mid-cycle, and they, about the time she's getting ready to ovulate, to kick an egg out, and they are making the lining of the uterus grow nice and thick and luxuriant with a rich blood supply. And that lining is there, that endometrium is there, so that if she gets pregnant, if a sperm finds that egg out in her fallopian tube, by the time the egg makes it down the tube and into the uterus, that lining is rich enough that the egg will, that new baby now that is about 3 or 4 days old, will now implant into the wall of the uterus, into the endometrium, that rich blood supply. And that's where the placenta will form and provide nutrition for the baby. If she doesn't get pregnant about a week or 10 days before her period is supposed to start, her progesterone levels drop, they plummet very low, and that then triggers that endometrium to slough off, to die and slough off and drain out through the cervix, out through the vagina, and that's her menstrual period.
Okay.
So what she's doing, her menstrual period is actually that lining of the uterus that was designed to support a baby being replaced, draining out, getting rid of it to make a new one next month to give her another shot at pregnancy.
Okay.
Now, sometimes, in some unfortunate women, some of that endometrium, instead of sliding out through the vagina as a menstrual bleed, will actually reflux its way out the tubes.
Oh, wow.
And some of that endometrium will then go out the tubes into her belly, around the uterus or the tubes or the ovaries, and it'll start to grow there. And then what happens is, when she is, during the month, she's actually getting luxuriant endometrium, not just in her uterus, but some out inside her belly. And then when the progesterone drops, she bleeds inside her belly.
Oh, wow.
Instead of just inside her uterus to run out. And so she's then got blood in around her internal organs. And that blood is exquisitely irritating and causes a lot of pain.
Wow. Okay. And
so those endometrial implants, you can go in with a laparoscope and hunt for them and find them and laser them and destroy them. And that will get rid of the pain if you get them all.
Okay.
But that's hunting and pecking, and you're looking for all these little tiny implants all around the bowel and stuff. And,
okay.
And you don't want to burn bowel. So okay. it's a touchy surgery and so effective. Or we can just put her on hormones that will shut down her period completely. And for instance, we put her on birth control pills so that her progesterone never drops. And then over time, that high progesterone level, if it's never goes up and down like it's supposed to, that will kind of atrophy those endometrial implants, and they'll shrivel up and get smaller and cause less trouble.
Okay.
So if we stop her cycling, we'll stop her pain.
And that's with endometriosis.
That's with endometriosis. Okay. That's
one of the three.
One
oh boy.
Of multiple possibilities. Okay. So, you know, I mean, here on the radio show, I can give people some guidance. I can give them some ideas. I can point them to who they ought to go see.
What's a good test?
I can't really diagnose them.
For her, for somebody that's having painful periods. Get into your doctor, first of all.
Yes, get in. And you need a good gynecologist who's willing to get in and do some studies. You know, for instance, if they do a high-resolution ultrasounds, they might actually see that free blood and so on in your belly. The real diagnostic gold standard, of course, would be to put her to sleep and drop a laparoscope through her belly. Just make a little incision in her belly button and drop the scope in and look and see if you see bleeding foci around her ovaries or her bowel. Okay. Now you've got 100% diagnosis.
Okay. Very good. Oh, Alex, we hope you'll get some answers, get into your doctor, and hopefully that will happen very soon. We've got some phone calls we're going to dive into in just a moment. We're going to take a quick break first. Here is that number for you to call whatever you would like to talk about. 1-800-465-8770. That's 1-800-465-8770. We are going to talk with Lori in just a moment and Teresa in just a second. Stay tuned. This is Leading Edge Medicine. We'll be right back. It's Leading Edge Medicine. Hi there. Good morning. I'm Lynette here along with Dr. Jerry Mixon, and we are talking about your health, your concerns, symptoms you're dealing with. We are going to head to Bothell right now, and we have Lori on the line. Welcome, Lori.
Hello, Lori.
Hi, how are you guys?
We're good.
Ooh, we are so good.
Go ahead. I have a question. Do you guys, any of you know what a hemorrhoid?
Your home for concern.
Right. Oops, go ahead.
Cyst or a dermoid?
Dermoid cyst? Yeah, yes, I do. Yeah. A dermoid cyst. Okay, let me see if I can go back and do a little basic human physiology here.
Okay.
Ovarian cysts are very common to start with.
Okay.
Before you were born, you had every egg you were ever going to have in your life already. In fact, you had more of them. You had somewhere between 3 and 6 million eggs in your ovaries that were immature and just waiting to ripen up and get released. You didn't use any of them for obviously before you were born. So by the time you were born, that was down to probably 1 million. Those eggs had died. Just think, remember, these are eggs like the ones you buy in the grocery store. How long can you store those?
Yeah.
You know? And by the time you hit puberty and started to menstruate, they'd been in storage another 13 years or so. Okay. And then for the next, 20 years, maybe 30 years, you released one per month.
Only one.
One per month. Okay. That on average would get released. So you're not using a lot of those millions of eggs, and they continue to die. In fact, by the time you're in your 20s, you're probably down to 500,000 eggs, something like that. I mean, it's a much smaller number than you started with. And in order to get those eggs out of the ovary, you have what we call a follicular cyst. You get a where that egg is getting ready to be released. It forms this little fluid-filled pocket, and it works its way to the surface, and it ruptures and releases the egg. And some women can actually feel that mid-cycle when they're at their most fertile point. They'll kind of get this little owie, and that's where they're actually releasing an egg, and that's a great time to get pregnant if you want to have unprotected intercourse. Some eggs don't get released. The covering, the thickening over the top is so thick, they just sit there. And the cyst may get bigger and bigger and bigger. And sometimes you'll get women who will have cysts that are bigger than the rest of the ovary put together. It's just a great big fluid-filled sac that started off to be a place to release an egg, and it's now just a great big round fluid-filled thing. Once in a while, fairly rare, but we don't like to see them, there is a dermoid cyst. Remember that egg, that baby to be, has the potential to be an entire human being. It's got all the genetic code to make a new person, including hair, teeth, bones, heart, lung, etc. A dermoid cyst is an egg that has started to develop as though it had been fertilized. And it's making random components. And dermoids often have bone, hair, skin, epithelial cells, a mix of different components of a person, not organized like a baby,
okay,
just in kind of a random mishmash. And those occasionally can become malignant, can be cancerous. And so a malignant dermoid is very different from a plain dermoid, a benign dermoid. But dermoid cysts are just an unusual form of cyst, and where we've got kind of an egg that is going partway towards making a person, but not in the typical progression where it's got two sets of DNA and is really ready to make a full human being.
But do they need to be removed, doctor, or will they?
If we see them, because you do the ultrasound, and instead of seeing just a smooth, fluid-filled sac with a normal ovarian cyst, you get this mixed densities that don't form a baby pattern. They just form kind of a jumble.
Okay.
And then if you go in and take that cyst out, because you don't know what it is,
okay,
until you get there.
Would you have pregnancy symptoms with something like this?
Not usually.
Okay.
Not usually. Now, there's not usually enough organization to that tissue to be releasing hormones.
Okay.
Okay, because my daughter's 30, and she's going in Wednesday for a ultrasound over in Kirkland.
Uh-huh.
And she had an MRI done on, she went to Dr. Nelson for a piriformis muscle, and they gave her an injection, and they found this on when they did the MRI, and they said it may present a dermoid or a whatever that word is, cyst, and it would be a good idea to go get an ultrasound. And so, of course, she panicked, and I thought, oh, God.
Yes.
So she is on bioidentical hormones. That wouldn't have anything to do with...
No. No, in fact, her hormone levels are high enough, it should help prevent her from forming cysts or releasing eggs. I mean, if you're taking enough in the way of the hormone levels, you've effectively got a birth control method going on.
Okay. So I guess that kind of answers my question. When we get the ultrasound done, we will take it from there.
Yep. All right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There we go. Thank you, Lori.
Bye-bye.
Now, doctor, I've heard of cysts bursting. Would that type of a cyst burst on the ovary, or is that
less likely? But if you got a woman who has like polycystic ovarian disease, in which she forms lots and lots and lots of cysts on her ovary, and they rupture with regularity, if they rupture and it's just the cyst fluid, they get pain for a short period of time.
Okay.
Minutes usually, and then the fluid gets reabsorbed within an hour or so, and the pain has gone away. But once in a while, when they rupture, they tear across a blood vessel.
Ah.
And then you bleed into your pelvis, and blood is great stuff in blood vessels. Mm. But it's incredibly irritating and painful to have it out in the peritoneum, out in the abdominal cavity.
Okay. All right. We're learning so much today. Thank you for tuning in. Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon. Here is that number to get through. 1-800-465-8770. That's 800-465-8770. Headed to Puyallup, we have Teresa on the line. Hi there, Teresa. Welcome.
Hello, Teresa.
Hi. Excuse me. Hi. I have a question. I found out I have colon cancer, which I probably, they're guessing, I've had it maybe for a year and a half to a year.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the exact size of it because she didn't mention it, but it looked like it, I'm 5 feet tall, but it looks like it could fit in the palm of my hand flat. But anyway, nobody can tell me what stage I'm in, how important is that, and how important is it to see a hematologist-oncologist?
Seeing your oncologist as quickly as possible is important. And I'm surprised they didn't mention at least some estimates of staging, but they're probably waiting for the surgery to do that.
They want to remove it first. Is that why, doctor?
Yeah. Staging a colon cancer, here's kind of how it works in general terms. Most of the time, you form a polyp. We call it adenomatous polyp, and this is this kind of stalk with a little growth on the head of the polyp. Most colon cancer starts at the tip of that polyp.
Mm, okay.
And as long as if we can find it with a periodic colonoscopy or something and remove the polyp before the cancer gets down to the base, to the colon wall, you're cured. That's pretty neat.
Okay.
When it gets down and grows all the way to the base of the polyp and now is spreading into the wall of the colon itself, that's more serious.
Okay.
If it invades down into and through the wall of the colon, that's another extension. If it extends all the way through the colon and spreads out into other internal organs, now we're looking at a stage four cancer, which is very, you know, nasty and hard to treat. So the staging makes a big, big difference. And that's going to depend on several things. First, how aggressive, once they get the tumor itself and they can run genetic tests on the tumor and see what its genome says, there are markers that say this is a slower growing or this is a very aggressive tumor or this is a tumor that has a propensity to spread early. When they see how deep it has gone, when they see whether or not it is extended beyond the wall of the colon, when they do the workup to see is it in other organs yet that we can tell, that all changes the staging, and that changes the therapy dramatically.
Okay.
Is
that helpful,
that
Teresa?
I know. Well, yes, yes, it was. The question I have is, if I need the staging now, if that's possible through the hematologist, oncologist, or whatever, if I need the staging now, that would tell me what kind of treatment I have to have now and in the future.
Yeah, but to really get the full staging, you actually have to get in surgically and look at the tumor itself. You know, you need to do the genetic tests on the tumor, so that means you got to get a piece of it. So that means you got to get it in the laboratory. And when the surgeon gets in there, he'll be able to tell very quickly, you know, is this something that is just inside the lumen of the colon and is not invading? You know, when you say you could hold it in your hand, that can be anywhere from, you know, a few millimeters to five or six centimeters. So that's a big difference in tumor size. If they're telling you they think you've had it for at least a year, year and a half, that tells me that it's probably going to be a later stage. I mean, I bet we're looking at at least a stage two or three. So
she's thinking a three.
Yeah, I say at least a two and probably a three. And we hope not a four, because your survival goes down rapidly as each stage goes up. So, you know, we need to get you into the oncologist. We need to get you into the surgeon. We need to get you evaluated by the chemo, you know, the chemo people, which is the oncologist and or the radiation people, and see what your options are. But first, you got to know what you're dealing with. So first diagnosis, then therapy. Okay?
Well, can you explain to me a hematologist, oncologist?
Well, the two go together. Hemonco is kind of a combined specialty because hematologists are looking primarily for blood cancers, bone marrow cancers, blood hematologic cancers. And the oncology says the other kinds of cancers. For some reason, decades ago, back when medicine was a lot less sophisticated, we had hematologists and we had oncologists. Hematologists, the only cancers they treated were the leukemias and, you know, blood dyscrasias. And then the oncologists treated the rest of them. And now we have guys that are cross-trained. They look at the whole gamut of cancer. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Well, yes, you did. You're doing a great job. On the blood one, can they look into the blood and see if there's active cells, cancer cells in the body?
Actually, yes. We now have some tests that will look for protein markers in the circulating bloodstream that have been released into your blood by the cancer cells. Yes. And the later the stage, the more of those protein markers are likely to be in your blood. But looking for those markers in your blood is not adequate to do the staging. You just got to get in and look at the cancer itself and see how wide it's spread.
Okay, I see. Well, you did a great job in helping me, so I appreciate your help.
You're welcome, ma'am. Please get into your doctor as quickly as possible. And if they give you much in the way of delays, raise hell. Be
your best.
Be your best, Karen.
Yes. Right.
Okay. I've got a good team.
Good.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
You're welcome, ma'am. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for that call, Teresa. We're taking your calls, too. We have one more hour on Leading Edge Medicine and room for you. Phone lines are open at 1-800-465-8770. That's 800-465-8770. We'll be right back.